Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking why journalism really, really matters. Now more than ever, maybe. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and the man who rails against the machine, for better and for worse, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you, buddy?
Not too bad. And yourself, Tony?
Good, good. Listen, folks, just while I have you all here, very quickly, I know I'm a pain in the hole, but please head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We do need the support. We appreciate everybody who does come on board. It really makes a difference. But, we are literally hand to mouth on these things.
This pod was recorded before the European elections. So just bear that in mind when you're listening to this one. Thanks.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin and candidate in the upcoming European elections for runner feminist foodie Lynn Boylan. Lynn, thanks for coming back to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It was the last time you were here as part of your series of Climate Change, the whole story. You were here with Professor Aviva Chomsky and we kind of went through on a digression, if you remember, at the time about the media plurality, how things were reported and why we were, were they speaking truth to power or were they too comfortable around power? Recently we've seen, as we said, goodbye to Redacted. Dennis O'Brien has now divested himself of INM. Are we more hopeful?
No. in this one word answer, I suppose, look, it's welcome that Dennis has left the print media stage. He hasn't left the broadcast media stage yet. He's still there in Communicorp. But I suppose for us, I suppose we know that Dennis O'Brien had a huge influence in terms of the media sector in Ireland. But there's also a lot of other issues around media and that needs to be fixed. And the report that my political group commissioned, I called for an expert group to be set up to look at the media landscape, and the National Union of Journalists also called for that same expert group, because we have to look at not just the ownership, it's the cross-sectoral ownership, it's the diversity of voices, and also about how do you have a sustainable media, how do they pay and make sure that they have a future ahead of them.
I think that's really key, because there's two models there. There's the model that has to sustain itself, and that's continually in conflict with the actual ability to tell the story. And what we're seeing more and more often now is, as you said, the diversity of voices isn't actually that diverse when, you know, you have one political correspondent covering, whether it's 98 FM or FM 104 or indeed News Talk or whatever it is, and they cover all of that. So you're not going to, with the greatest respect to Sean Defoe, who we've had on the show, and I like him, but Sean has to cover so many things. It's hard to get that, as you say, diversity.
It is, and just the sector itself has become, I suppose years ago, you looked at journalism as being a profession and a skill, and that people had time, they were given time by their editor to go away, investigate a story, and you mightn't have heard from them for weeks, sometimes in case months. But now there's so much pressure on journalists that they have to turn over the story really quickly. They're regurgitating press statements that come out as guilty. We put out press statements and you'll see that it's just cut and paste. So it's about how do we, I suppose, invest in journalists to go and do the job and for them not to go into the idea of just clickbait, you know, either just regurgitating a press statement or going for something that they know is going to generate revenue because it's slightly controversial.
I find when you say, I want to go back on the issue around the picking up on the release of press statements, because it is very infuriating when, say, let's take the housing crisis, and we've seen only in, I think it was February, where the government released a press statement saying Rebuilding Ireland has exceeded all its targets. Within minutes, RTE had Rebuilding Ireland has exceeded all its targets. It said it three times in the one thing. And again, when you dig down into it, they were talking housing solutions, not actual house builds. When you talked about the actual houses that they were built, 97% of the houses built were built by the private market, and the state were buying them from the private market. They weren't building them. And we don't have a method for actually, whether it's they don't have time to actually get it right, or they don't even have a way of correcting that. That's a big concern.
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen, particularly with the Minister for Housing, was this releasing of very detailed information late at night or on a bank holiday weekend. And, like, look, print has to go out. Newspapers have deadlines they have to print. So it's very, very difficult for a journalist to be able to dig into those press statements in detail and analyse it. I think, in fairness to some journalists, they were so frustrated by the fact that the minister was doing this that they then started reporting on that, that it was unfair of them. But it is very, very hard for journalists to spend the time to dig into the numbers and to get that balance that is required in journalism.
Well, we saw just recently that the FOI of that letter for the Morgan Waterford, we've seen how that has panned out in the media, in that a journalist did due diligence, got the information, put it out there, and it was immediately rubbished by the Taoiseach. That journalist is now out on a limb. He's in a precarious position. And that's also feeding into the problems within media, is that so many journalists are precariously employed. They have to write a particular way to guarantee that they'll get paid. Now, it's none of this is overt. This is all very below the surface. You've got to make your money. If you submit a 300-word piece and it's really anti-government and you're trying to put it into INM, you're not going to get paid.
Yeah, and it's the whole, as you said, it's kind of slightly subversive as to how it happens. And people would say, you know, even when we were talking about Dennis's influence over the media, it's not that he's going in to the editorial room and saying, I want this story. It's that it's in the back of a journalist's mind or the editor's mind that going, if I run this story, is it going to annoy the shareholder? Is my job on the line? And that's why it's so important, I suppose, that you don't have political influence, but that you do create a framework that protects the sector and that journalists can do, so they have decent working conditions, but also that they have that freedom of going and reporting the truth. And we've seen that issue as well around the National Development Plan and the advertising. And the most recent report to come out of the EU on Ireland on media plurality highlighted very significantly that Ireland's revenue in print media is through the floor. So if you're an editor of a newspaper and you are relying on advertising to keep your show on the road, and then the government comes to you and says, we want to run these ads, you don't want them to look like they're public state advertising, will you do it? It's very hard, you know, to make that call, because you're responsible for other people's jobs as well and your livelihoods.
And so, it's not just the government. We only saw last weekend gone, Johnny Ronan ran an anonymous ad about the skyline in Dublin, we have to go up. And, you know, these are vested interests. This was allowed to run anonymously in one of our national newspapers. And people are looking at it going, this checks out. But it's purely, there's no editorial control on that. And then when you take it back to the individual journalist, I often mention Dale Wickersham and how she was treated within News Talk. And she speaks about it herself, that she didn't even realise she was doing self-censorship. Because, you know, and we've had people talk about pulling their punches. They pull their punches particularly, and I'm going to take shit for this, but a lot of the political correspondents know that in the corridors of power, that the relationship is too comfortable. We see too many people making the transition from reporting on politics to working as special advisors. It's far too comfortable. And without that adversarial at least put some fear into the government or the power of the day, and without doing that, you're not really holding anybody to account.
Yeah, I mean, and it's ironic that sometimes my party gets criticism for not being close enough, you know, and that
But you shouldn't have that cozy relationship between journalists and politicians. Absolutely, you have civic relationships. You can sit down and brief journalists on certain detailed aspects, but it shouldn't be a cozy relationship where you're out socialising. And that, you know, to some people that might sound odd, but that's the truth. If you're friends with somebody, socialising with them regularly, and then you come across a tip off that that person is doing something untoward, or, you know, just something that's in the public interest to know, are you going to be less likely to cover that story if you've got that cozy relationship? So it is about the separation of the two. But also, as I said, what we're calling for is that expert group, because I don't have all the answers, but there's lots of experts out there who do, is to bring them together and go, how do you create a framework in Ireland that ensures that we have that independence of media, we protect journalists in doing their jobs, it's well funded, and it has the diversity of voices that we require. And in Denmark, they've done this, and they got across political support to to set up a group and go away. And they regularly update us because media is constantly changing. And we know that through the social media platforms as well. But you do need the political will to take it on.
But media, I suppose in Ireland, media isn't really constantly changing. It's quite stagnant and has been for 20 odd years.
Oh, and in terms of the publications and that, I suppose it's just in terms of how you regulate the, like we've seen the issues around the advertising on the Facebooks and the Twitters and those sort of during the repeal referendum and how difficult it was to try and control it. So you have to have, I suppose, a framework that's flexible enough to allow you to adapt to those things. But you're right, we haven't had anything. Like there's no, like if you're anyway to the left, what are your publications that you have to read on a daily basis?
Well, even in right across the board in media, you can't name one even slightly left-leaning personality journalist. There isn't one, not one.
No,
there is no broadcast you can turn on where you're going to listen to slightly left of center views. You're not going to get it anywhere.
No, and the thing is, when you hear somebody on that's actually talking, whether they're invited guests, you sort of go, wow, that was a breath of fresh air, that somebody was not just trotting out the same line. I mean, we have a national broadcaster that regularly interviews its own broadcasters. Yeah. Sitting around a table interviewing each other. You know, it's not, that's not good quality public broadcasting.
Well, we could lose Dancing with the Stars if we don't pay more in our license fee. I say, into the bin with it, never watched it, don't care.
Yeah, I mean, RTE is the, so with the report on the media, concentration of media ownership in Ireland, the two big players was Independent News and Media and RTE. And I am absolutely never going to call for us to dismantle RTE. I think it's really important to have a public broadcaster, but we also need to look at how it's set up and should it be broken up into different sectors so that there's a little bit of diversity. They're not required to have the diversity of voices that they should have. I mean, Dee Forbes has made some improvements, but nowhere near where we need to be around having working class voices, ethnic voices. Do you know what I mean? Just like, okay, she's done some on terms of gender equality, but there's a whole range of diversity out there that's not represented. And they're not obliged to do it. I mean, I tried to get their gender equality policy and it took a freedom of information request. And what it turned out, it's a HR policy that any business would have, in that you can't discriminate in the, you know, in the
workplace. Well, we've seen it with a very recent report about the level of Irish language coverage that they did. It was less than 1%, and they were, you know, miles and miles away, and they were kind of going, well, did we not have TG Carr for that? And it was like, no, guys, you still are obliged to have some Irish language broadcasting. You know,
and that's the only sort of area that they are obliged to, and they're failing on that. Mm. So you can see why then we don't have the other diversity that we should have, because there's no legal obligation. There's also no obligation to monitor for bias in the broadcast media. So we know when there's an election 3 weeks out, they will time it and make sure that everybody gets their fair share of coverage. But that's not happening on an ongoing basis. And when people complain to me and say that was a shocking, you know, report and really biased against whatever, whether it's a foreign affairs policy, a party policy or whatever, and they're going like, how do they get away with that? I'm saying, well, you have to make the complaint, because unfortunately, they only react to complaints. So the onus is on the member of the public to ensure that there isn't bias in their public broadcaster that they're actually funding. And you can, that can easily be rectified as well in terms of use the third level institutions, those who are doing journalism, to just randomly monitor different shows. Mm. And if you're, again, an editor and you know your show is being randomly monitored for bias, that then is in the back of your head all the time.
With this committee, how do you propose to tackle what we'll say is the unbalanced media in Ireland? What steps can be taken?
What works in Denmark?
Yeah, what works in Denmark, really?
Yeah, I mean, it is, one is independence, two is the financial viability, and then ensuring that you have a level of diversity so that there's percentages around the diversity of ownership and ensuring that the voices are heard in it. So it's not that you could necessarily take the Danish model and implement it here, but we could learn a lot from it. The recent European Broadcasting Union study showed that Denmark actually has the highest levels of trust in its media. So they are doing something right, but they did get that cross political support to go, right, we create the framework to do it. And if we all do it together, because that's the argument has always been in Ireland. If you're, if you put your neck out and try and tackle media diversity, they're going to go and attack you, you know, because there's vested interests at play. So you do need that cross political buy-in.
We've seen that now. You mentioned Facebook. We've seen Facebook ads, for example, whereby we won't talk about, they're not actually required to show how much has been spent because we know that the government are the biggest spenders on Facebook ads. So, you know, why would you go against your own interests if it's only going to expose your own, advantages?
Yeah. And a big thing is transparency. So see on the state advertising, again, that was flagged twice in the EU reports that looked at Ireland. There's no regulatory framework for state advertising. So we know that under the current Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, spending has increased 126 times what was spent under the previous Taoiseach. But there's nowhere that you as a member of the public can go and say, okay, how is that money spent? And how did you decide on which publications you actually decided? So what Roddy Flynn looked at in his report, and he said, yes, there's clearly an emphasis on, you know, turnover and readership. That's clearly part of the decision they took when taking an ad out in that paper and not that one. But it's not transparent. And he said there was also other factors at play. And you can't see that. So that's part of the thing is, if yes, we have state advertising, then you should know how much is being spent, what it's been spent on, and also how they decided where they were spending that money. You know, so they decided on Facebook because of this factor. So they have it's something that you can just look at and verify that that's correct. Because the other thing around state advertising is it doesn't have to comply with the Advertising Standards Code. And that was the same with the Johnny Ronan advert. They broke no rules. And when we filed a complaint about the Air Code ad that Dennis Nocton took out at the time when he was minister, the Advertising Standards came back and said this advert violated four different codes of practice in the Advertising Standards. We're going to bring it to the board to see what will be done. And then when the board met, they went, actually, state advertising doesn't have to comply, so there's nothing we can do, even though they breached four of the guidelines.
We've seen it in terms of even the standards, in terms of taking complaints to the Data Protection Commissioner, all of these things, where the Data Protection Commissioner has then come back and more or less said, well, you know, simple things like, I know it's a different thing, but like, you want a FODA on your name? Well, you've no real full entitlement to a FODA on your name. And when it comes to the state, you know, whereas if it was a private provider, they'd have said to them, you know, well, you need to have a system that produces this, that spells the person's name correctly. Yeah. You know, I mean, there is really very much a two-tier structure there. But I want to get to the pay model, because the pay model is key here. What we find is there's a reason why, I won't even say the man's name, but there's a reason why he's getting coverage as an MEP candidate. It's because of the clickbait generation, that model of income based on eyeballs. And, we need to somehow break through the people that, you know, if junk in, junk out. And if you're going to just, if you can, don't, what was it we said once, Martin? You don't have to eat your vegetables anymore. Yeah. It used to be when you wanted to consume the news, you had to consume a broad plate of, you know, you got your veg, your meat, whatever it was you want. But now, if you just want to eat sweets all day, you can eat sweets all day. And that's the model. And that's actually now, it's not just, you know, for Joe.ie and the BuzzFeeds and these, it's not there anymore. It's populated the entire stratosphere of everything of our mainstream media now.
Yeah, no, if you're controversial and say something, it doesn't have to be backed up by any facts. You'll get a headline, and therefore then you'll generate the clickbait, as we call it. And we've seen that definitely when we were working on Ibrahim's case, that it was just the journal at the start. We were like, oh, it's great, they're covering the story. But then we realised why, because the level of comments and clicks it got. And you do have to put in place a pay model. And so what it was Minister Nocton as well, when he had the portfolio, was talking about giving some percentage of taxpayers' money to the newspapers. Now, I'd have serious concerns of that as well, because, well, like, that doesn't solve the problem of clickbait. So if you give, you know, X amount of money to all of the different print newspapers and don't put have conditions with it, well, then we're going to get more of the Dancing with Stars type print media. Mm. You know, the Kardashians, what have they done this week? As opposed to how do you invest in investigative journalism? There are models, again, in the EU that are very good. So in Belgium, there's a fund if you have something that's a cross-jurisdictional story. Mm-hmm. The Croatian model is really interesting because they use some of the money from the lotto funds. But it is for investigative stories. So you have to go to them, and it's not on a whichever publication you work for. It's you go as a journalist and say, I have this story. Would you fund me to investigate it? So there are models there that we could look at that you could use public money, but I would be very concerned of what was flagged at the time with Minister Nocton of just let's give them some money to subsidize.
Well, that's traditionally what we have done. We have thrown money at newspapers. I mean, we have thrown INM has been the benefit. Beneficiary of 140 million, 130 million.
Of write downs.
Yeah.
Dead write downs.
So yeah, and they got the preferential VAT rate now. In France, there's 0% VAT on print media. You could argue that that's a positive thing. But if you're going to use public money to subsidise something, then it has to come with the conditionality of that it's a public service. And that's how you deal with the clickbait. I think we need to start educating people in schools as well as to how to critically engage with the media and to actually go, well, find out what's the source of this story. Does it stack up? Cross-reference it with, are you reading stories the same in other newspapers? And I mean, and I've gone into secondary schools and kind of said that to students, you do need to also take a bit of responsibility for what you're reading and how you look at it. But we need to educate people how to do that. And I think that the pay model we've seen has become a little bit more popular in some, like in terms of music, in terms of your Netflix type. Are they paying enough? Probably not to the artists, but at least people are getting into the mind frame of you have to pay for content. The problem with the media sector in Ireland, I think, is just that there's that level of trust is gone.
Yeah.
And how do you restore the trust? Because without restoring the trust, people will just are not prepared to pay
and
for the media.
That's a key point, because two nice recent developments I've seen. Ken Fox is noteworthy. He's set up, which is basically he will tell you, we want to cover these topics. Can you fund the journalists to do this? It's, you know, 2 weeks' work. It's 3 weeks' work. They set a limit on how much they need to bring in. And once they fund it, the journalist knows he's paid for the next 3 weeks and he goes off and covers it. He or she then delivers the article. And, you know, it's not ideal, but it's a good way of dipping their toe into the water to see if that model is sustainable. You look at the other side of the thing, though, that is discouraging me is the fact that, we see the level of trust has gone down. And I think it's gone down for one reason and one reason only. The way it's covered a lot of the times now is it's covered like sports. It's covered by who's winning, who's losing, what have you heard, who's on the transfer list in terms of, you know, a cabinet reshuffle. And there's no discussion on, well, who has the policies? What is the legislation? What's getting done on the floor of the Dáil? What other alternatives are there? And, you know, we've gone to this, who's up, who's down. And we live for, and Martin, I'm pointing at you now because you're going like, that poll says this and this poll says that.
I hate polls. Yeah. And I think, it's the ultimate clickbait, political clickbait is polls. I can say since the last election, the changes have been, marginal. There is no real change since the last election. Therefore, there's no real story. Yet every month we have Red Sea, we have whatever poll
comes out.
So-and-so is up a point, so-and-so is down a point. All marginal error stuff. It's not a story. And yet it's portrayed as a story and built as a story, and it's a non-story. It just simply makes no difference.
No, and I think that's the thing as well, that people go, oh, well, if you're up, and like they'll talk to you and go, oh, people like to back a winner. Do you know what I mean? So it is influencing in terms of election coverage as well, and, you know, where people are and whether or not they're going to be a runner in the game or not. So, there's reasons for the polls as well. It's creating a story, but it also does, I suppose, protect the establishment that's already there.
Well, your party, suffers from polls greatly in two respects, because when they do well in a poll, they're always caveated with, but they never do well in an election. Yeah. It's the next.
Polls never reflect.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Results,
and, yeah. And then when they're down, they're saying, oh, they haven't got the bounce from the change of leadership. So it's really like, I can write the next 10 poll results now if you want, folks, hire me and I'll give you the next two paragraphs and you can just copy and paste them in as they come out every weekend or whatever it is. That sort of nonsense distracts from the key issues. And that's why when we talk about levels of media trust and we talk about why aren't we talking about actual solutions to the problems we face with housing, with health, with climate, with education, all of these things have to actually be discussed, but they're not. They're put that aside because, oh, you know what, actually, Owen Murphy, the Taoiseach continues to have confidence in him. And you're like, Owen Murphy is not the problem. If we change Owen Murphy for Owen Billy, it doesn't matter tomorrow unless we actually change the policy, the legislation. Why aren't we looking at that? Because that's not the game. The game is also
in Ireland, and I think the paywall system is working in other countries. Like, it's working with the New York Times. They're making money. But Ireland is such a small country. Your volume of sales have to be quite high to make any money. And nobody can make that volume of sales.
Unless you're Blind Boy.
Yeah, well, if Blind Boy brought out a newspaper, he could probably sell more than anything that's out there at the moment. But the actual model of newspapers is on the constant decline in Ireland. Paywall, no paywall. And it's because the population is actually quite small.
Which sort of then does make the case that you have to have some level of public support for it. I mean, state funding, but done in a way that ensures the independence and the separation, but that it is viable.
Well, I think, as we say, the meerkats will take care of that. Sooner or later, newspapers will start to go bust because they can't make any money, and a new model will emerge. I mean, this model where you have an oligarch at the top and a freelance journalist begging to get a few words printed at the bottom. That model is outdated. It's old. It's not sustainable as that model. It's just not sustainable.
No, I mean, the current model is definitely not sustainable. And that's what I'm saying. Whether it's public funding for investigative journalism as opposed to for publication, that could be the way forward. But part of the problem as well with the falling trust is that people then don't read, even though the level of, there are some really excellent journalists, I caveat with, in Ireland, but all of that rubbish of the different polls, and you know what the headline is going to say depending on what way the polls go, turns people off, and then they try and find alternative sources, and that's where then you go down the road of that sort of, I refuse to call it, like, well, the fake news, because fake news can be has been politicized as well, but the false information that's out there and that alternative news that people are looking for. Like, we want people to have alternative sources, but if they're not robust or they're disingenuous, then the trust is a real key to how you deal with the fake news side of it, but also around the sustainability of news
we must touch on fake news, and we must touch. And the honest to God truth is there has always been fake news. This is not a new phenomenon. Right. It has existed forever. And you are as likely to read fake news in a broadsheet as you are to hear fake news on Facebook.
Absolutely. And it's why I never accept the premise of fake news. Mm. There's the dissemination of false information, and deliberately so. But like, fake news is also great when people go, oh yeah, well, Donald Trump is the first to sort of really shout the fake news. But like, look at our Taoiseach this week with the Waterford hospitals. He didn't like the message, so he immediately sort of discredited it. He did the same when Ireland was shown to be the climate laggards that they are. He said, I don't like the you know, how they did their methodology or whatever. So
he did the same to Dr. Jim Gray when he was the Minister for Health.
He actually did the same to our compadre Rory.
We did the same with the Florida doll about Rory Hearn when Rory challenged him about the at the outset of the housing crisis when he was working in Dolphin House, I think, at the time. You know,
we have a very thin-skinned Taoiseach who goes personally after people. We also have another friend who got fairly lambasted by him as well. I'm not going to name who it is, but got fairly lambasted, and it's not forgotten about either. Here, it's certainly not forgotten about. How do we move forward? Do you think we're going to end up with the same model we have? Do you think we're going to have Irish Times in there going into the future? Or do you think there's room there for something else?
I think that we have to have something else, because we're seeing with the newspapers are going under, like local newspapers are disappearing. I can't see how the current model of your sort of few papers we have, print media left, continuing into the future without changing their model radically. How that model changes, as you said, there are people who can come forward with, whether it's a single journalist who's running or whether it's the Ken Fox model. But in the next 10 years, you're not going to see, I wouldn't say you'll have even four print newspapers in existence.
Yeah.
It's just not viable.
Even media house who've taken over INM are predominantly a digital based newspaper. That's their, you know, that's their bread and butter across the continent. So, you know, a lot of the time, the days of actual holding a newspaper, tactile touch of it, they're nearly gone now. You know, it'll be the rare bird where you'll see them folded up, and maybe that's for the better in a way. What we need, though, is we do need to see a sustainability. I'm more hopeful, Martin. I mean, why else would we keep doing this if we didn't think that there was need for media diversity, if there was need for other voices?
Chico, simple answer, Tony.
No, we're getting away with it so far. Just bringing it forward back to politics, this forthcoming election, people need to understand what actually is at stake here. There's an erosion. Going into climate, there's an erosion of the centrist vote, and I use that term broadly, in the broadest sense. And the options seem to be to me, there are people on the far right who are looking to gain ground, and there are people what they're loosely grouped as Nordic Greens and left. You know, if we don't think tactically as we vote in Ireland, we risk actually seeing the rise of that far right capturing more of that centrist vote that's gone away.
Yeah, like the centrist politics have failed. Not just the people of Ireland, they failed the people across the EU. And that's why you're seeing the hollowing out of the centre, because it doesn't work. Mm. I mean, what you have in the EU for the last decade or more is what we've seen with the Fine Gael Labour government, is that it just doesn't work. Those who are supposed to be left of centre need to coalesce with people who are left of centre in terms of ideology. They just get swallowed up and nobody gains other than a very small percentage of the population. And that's what's happened across the EU. But I also am always flagging the point that the so-called centrists, which is the EPP, love to talk about the fact that they're the centre and the centre must hold, and for the benefit of Europe going forward, the centre must hold. And you're like, you're not that centrist anymore.
No.
Because within that bloc, you've got some very dubious characters, and it's not just the Viktor Orban's Fidesz party, but even the Popular Party in Spain. You know, this is a party that has locked up democratically elected politicians because they exercised the mandate they were given, and nobody's talking about it. Mm. So you're right, we have a problem of the rise of the very far right, but we also need to call out where it's existing in the so-called centre, because the Irish media have not covered that at all. I've been talking about it since 2015, and I think only finally Elaine Byrne probably was the first to actually do any sort of story on the fact that the EPP has far right elements within it. But for the next election, for people, and I say this at the debates that I've taken part in, it doesn't matter what any candidate sitting on the panel tells you. In order for you to vote strategically in the next election, look at what their political groups represent and look at the policies that they have. So it doesn't matter if Fine Gael stands there and tells you we do not want to support an EU army. If Fianna Fáil is the same, we're absolutely opposed to, you know, further militarisation. Both of the political groups, ALDE and the EPP, have it in their manifestos: we want an EU army.
Mm. So, and it was in the future of Ireland, future of the EU document, that briefing
every
document.
Every single paper.
Like, there were six options on the floor on the document, and all of them included basically some form of PESCO. And all of them were more or less hinting at Fortress Europe.
Exactly. And regardless of whether one or two individual Irish MEPs abstain on a certain thing, the point is, if you return MEPs in any EU country to those big political blocks, they're going to have the majority and they're going to vote and bring Europe in a direction. So you do have to think strategically as to which political groups you should be supporting. And of course, to counteract the rise of the far right, then, well, I'm obviously going to say that, but you should vote certainly for progressive, because the only way to challenge the far right is through progressive voices, not the centre, which we see constantly shifting and pandering to the far right.
They always say the centrist thing is the old Indian phrase that, you know, the man who rides around on a tiger, one day the tiger will look up at him. And that for me is always the centrist. He's like, well, you know, and he always ended up, didn't realize I was appeasing this guy for so long. And then one day he's dinner.
Yeah.
And that is what has actually been emerging.
There is hope this time around that there may be a shift within the EU. It has been quite to the right for a long time. But this time around, there is hope that there will be more of a shift towards what we would deem true centre, which they would call the left. And we would just deem it true centre. It's actually true centre, is now called left. But there is a shift, or there is a hope of a shift this election.
There is, and like, regardless of the makeup of the parliament, any, I suppose, decrease in the numbers, certainly that the EPP have, I think, is going to benefit everybody, because they have had such a stranglehold over policy. You go into any negotiation, and no matter what file it is, if EPP don't support the position, all they need is one other political group to back them up.
Yeah,
and they have the numbers. And it's really frustrating when you go in and the rapporteur of a report will go, well, what does EPP think? And if they go, no, we don't support that. Do you mean, it's just really, really hard to get stuff across the line. So if their numbers are reduced, that's a positive. Of course, I don't want to see the far right in huge numbers in the parliament, but I do want to see EPP decreased in numbers to break the stranglehold that they have currently in there. And if you look at what happened in Spain in the elections, like the Popular Party reduced by 50%,
that's right, yeah,
their representation, I think people in EPP will be very, very concerned about that. And if you have the same happening in a couple of other countries that have large numbers of MEPs, then that's a positive, I think, for everybody.
And actually, that Spanish story is a very good reflection on Irish media, in that the Irish media talked about how well the right had done in that election. And yet the right had pretty much had its nose very bloodied in that election. And it was the left that did better, far better. Yet it was portrayed that the right had made...
Framing, Martin.
Yeah, yeah. It was framed that the right had done quite well.
And they did exactly the same with the Swedish election.
Yeah.
So the poll showed the far right doing better. They didn't. That didn't materialise into votes. And actually, the argument was in Spain is that 90% of people rejected the far right.
Yeah, yeah. And that was
the real
story.
That's the message, yeah. You know, that you're always going to have, you know, a small percentage of people who are on that.
But we didn't read that in Irish media, anywhere in Irish media.
Not just in Irish media. It's systemic. I mean, I was reading something last night where, this is hilarious. Yesterday, there was a story that Corbyn had written a foreword for a re-release of a book that was written in the 1920s. And because the book contained references to the Rothschilds, he was an anti-Semite again. And, you know, obviously, I think there are issues of anti-Semitism, and I abhor it. I think it just has to be stamped out everywhere. But I was reading a book last night about Jerusalem, about the first time as a foreign minister, Churchill arriving, and they were chanting, they were literally chanting, behead the Jews, and he was waving and smiling and grinning, and I'm going, I wonder if I screenshot that and send it to Sky News, will they say, look in this book where Churchill was doing this, will they talk about it? But of course they won't. It's framing.
Absolutely,
bringing it back to the big issue, and I mean this as the big issues that are now facing us. Obviously, you've done a lot around climate change. You've had your series of talks, which were terrific. You brought over great speakers. We need to broaden that into, I see that you have brought a book there, Climate Emergency Manifesto. We do need to talk about calling a climate emergency. And it's no good just even in Leinster House. It has to be broader than that.
We need to call a climate emergency, which would allow us then to, I suppose, if challenged in the courts, to have test cases, because once you declare an emergency in terms of state funding, and just measures you take possibly around property rights, do you know what I mean? They can be taken into account once there is an emergency called. At the moment in the EU, they're not even, all of the measures they're taking aren't even compliant with the Paris Agreement, let alone a level of emergency that we know we're in. So we were, I suppose, our office, I'm the spokesperson for my political group, or I was at the moment. And that's why we said, look, we need to be, do our response to the Fridays for Future, but also the issues around that we need to frame it now as an emergency. And because I suppose one of the frustrating things for me is the level of corporate capture that's out there of certain green NGOs and green politicians across the EU, that they really believe that you can just have green capitalism. So that was sort of our logic for this climate emergency manifesto is, no, we need radical thinking. We're in a crisis. We need to just go in there with that crisis frame of mind, and you're not going to fix it without systemic change. I would argue socialism could be the answer, but I'm open to other suggestions. But what we do know is you need system change. You cannot continue with the growth model we have.
There was a terrific
and
article.
Deal with climate change.
There was a terrific article 2 days ago, which was really funny. It was very dystopian, where it showed that they can make mechanical trees to take carbon. I would have thought a tree would have done the job, but, you know.
We're investing millions of public money in the EU in carbon capture storage, which hasn't even been proven to be effective, when we know what does capture carbon is our peatlands and our trees. So if we invested that amount of money into rewilding and forestation, and not the Sitka spruce forestation that's our current government wants, but proper rewilding, then that's how you take the carbon out of the atmosphere. But also we're investing huge amounts of money into gas infrastructure, and under the premise of, well, gas is a bridging fuel to deal with climate change. It's nonsense. The reason why the EU is investing huge amounts of money into gas infrastructure is because they want to get back at Russia. It's a geopolitical thing that we want to have a sustainable gas market without having to rely on Russia for gas.
And even if we burn what we've already, whatever we already extracted, we'll lock in 2 degrees of warming as it is. You know, these are the things that people don't seem to, the message needs to get through. We've already locked in 1 to 1.5. We're tipping into the 2 if we just burn what we've done, and we're still printing licenses in Ireland to take more.
And I mean, that was at the weekend, the license application that's gone in from ExxonMobil and the Chinese company, the Chinese state company, to explore off the coast of the west coast of Ireland and Kerry and Cork. Like ExxonMobil have been shown to spend millions over decades subverting the truth on climate change. They were investing in putting out climate denial articles, and yet now we're going to more than likely issue them a license to.
The coal lobby did that 3 generations ago, said that miners didn't get TB because the mining protected their lungs.
Yeah.
You know, they literally said this was a story.
But I do think we need a change in this country. I think we have the least ambitious government in my book we've ever had. Their lack of ambition is dumbfounding. I mean, rebuilding Ireland, 125 years just to take care of the people who are on the housing list right now. You know, 125 years. They've kicked the problem 125 years down. It's incredible when you sit back and you think about it. But they are the least ambitious government. Their ambition was to become government. And beyond that, they had no ambition. And I'm going to single out the Taoiseach in particular. His ambition was to become Taoiseach. He never thought beyond that. He never thought, what can I do as Taoiseach? It was just, I want to be Taoiseach. I think it's time to move on. I think it's time to say, well, okay, Leo, you've become Taoiseach now. Hollywood awaits. Off you go. Let's get people in who have some real ambition, some real vision for the future.
Yeah, and have, I suppose, the public interest at heart, because you can put aside differences of ideology, but like, absolutely no fan of Enda Kenny, but I think Enda Kenny at least was in politics for the right reasons, in that he had the public interest. We can disagree about what he did, but I just think that with Leo, it's all about ambition. This was about a goal of becoming the Taoiseach. He's thin skinned. He has no vision for where he wants to see Ireland. It was about the role and nothing more. Yeah.
He had set up the Campaign for Leo website 5 or 6 years before there was ever a contest. I mean, it was always
his goal. So, you know.
I don't think he's unusual across, or even across the world. I mean, you have Trump, who just wanted to be president. You have Macron, who just wanted to be president. Yeah. You know, you have these people who have a complete lack of ambition of what they do when they actually get there. And we went for Trump aside, we went for the posh pretty boys. And do we need them? Do we really need them? Have they achieved anything? No, they haven't. Let's go for growers.
Yeah, but take identity politics out of it, Martin, and start talking about actual policies and legislation. Let's talk about, say, how you link climate to housing, how you make 30,000 or 20,000 to 30,000 social and affordable public houses every year that are passive and, you know, energy efficient. That's the policies that you need to see. It goes back to what the UN Special Rapporteur said, that Ireland has failed. And the reason, in their right and their obligation to provide the provision of adequate housing, and the reason they're failing is because even though they have a plan, month on month, they're not getting any better. So you can't even, because the plan doesn't say everybody gets a 3-bedroom semi dropped out of the sky. It simply says that the government have to show a roadmap to make sure they're going to house adequate provision of housing for everybody. But it's failing every month. And Damien English yesterday stood up and said, our plan is working. So if you're going to do that, well, then no, you're in cloud cuckoo land. You're in denial because, you know.
I mean, you'd be generous, Tony. You're saying it's denial. I mean, it's not denial. It's lies. And we can say that. And, this thing, if your child lies, you can say you're lying. If a politician lies, you have to say it was an untruth. No, it's a freaking lie. Yeah. You know, it's a lie.
But I just find it bizarre that Fine Gael, the party who sort of pride themselves on the party of the economy, the party of business,
fiscally responsible,
and like they have failed on everything.
I know
everything. Mm. I mean, the children's hospital, the broadband.
I just heard housing.
400,000 was their latest. The government's own latest report said they spent over 400,000 purchasing basically land that the NAMA had bequeathed more or less to private developers. That their own report said we could have built for 200,000.
Yeah.
How is that fiscally responsible? It's not.
Yeah, the public-private partnership model they're going for in terms of providing social housing is going to cost us more in the long run as well. The same with the health centres.
We saw the shockwaves with that with the schools, and that should have burned everybody's fingers. They should have taken a step back and said, is this really the best way to do it? No, just plough on.
And instead, at the time when the first issues came out with the schools a couple of years ago, they argued that the EU prevented them from blocking those companies from tendering for the licence. And again, we went and asked the commission and they were going, nonsense. They'll have to just do it on every individual application. But of course, if somebody is shown to build shoddy buildings or buildings that are not safe in a fire, you can preclude them from applying for another tender.
But this lowball game came into existence here, and those in the know knew, just be the lowest bid. Doesn't matter. Your bid doesn't matter what's written on the piece of paper. You just put the lowest piece bid in, you get it, the job, and then you can start piling on your extras after that. And they knew this was the game, and that's what happened. And they absolutely knew. There was no mystery to anybody what was going on. I feel sorry for the guys who actually went in and costed and priced and said, well, actually, we could actually, if we cut down to the nub, we could build it for X. And then somebody comes in, oh, we can do it for half that. How can you do it for half that? Don't have to show you.
Don't have to show you, exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
And they get away with us, you know, and because we have to have a children's hospital, we have to have broadband. Mm. So we suddenly forgive them for throwing money away.
At this stage, we could put our own satellite in space, geostationary orbit above Ireland for the price it's going to cost to put satellite or broadband in Ireland. It's just gone beyond the
beginning. And going back to the climate change, again, their policy's failing. Mm. They haven't reached, they're not reaching any of their targets. We're going to be fined. Mm. And what's their response to the fines? Instead of going, well, we got to get our act together and now call the emergency, put huge amounts of public funding into public transport, into, you know, a sustainable farming model, into rewilding. No, we're going to buy carbon credits from countries like Brazil that are actually cutting the rainforests down.
You buy carbon credits and then you hear of people who are denied, indigenous people denied access to their hunting grounds because someone in Leinster House has bought your bit of forest.
Yeah.
I mean, this is insanity. This is finding a market where and creating human misery pure capitalism.
It's, and it's why, like, why we're so opposed to the idea of pricing carbon in the first place, because that's what happens. Do you know what I mean? It's, you cannot, like, rely on the markets and put a price on pollution and go, right, well, that's it. That solves the problem. No, it just doesn't work. And even with the Brazilian case, like, we've contacted Minister Coveney and said, look, you shouldn't be supporting the trade deal with Brazil, the Mercosur deal, because we now know that we have a man who's in power who said he's going to cut down the rainforest, who is going to trample all over indigenous people's rights. The LGBT community now are really vulnerable. That's not an issue for us. We support Mercosur. Like, that's human rights. And yet this is the same minister who launched a document about human rights and corporate responsibility.
You're out on the doors. Got to change it a little. You're out on the doors and you're canvassing. What are you hearing back? What are the issues you're getting on the doors?
Housing is the biggest issue.
That's the big
and
issue.
It was the biggest issue in 2014. And that's the tragic reality.
But people didn't vote that way in 2014. They didn't vote like housing was the biggest issue.
No, they did, like, I suppose in the local and European elections, they did return more progressives than in the previous time around. I think the problem for a lot on the doors is that 2016, the general election, didn't bring change.
Yeah.
And they're now associating all politicians with going, but sure, what's the point in voting? Because we voted differently and we're getting the same thing. And you're having to have those conversations about, well, this election is important, but the general election is really, really important whenever it happens. Because if you keep voting the same two parties, you're going to keep getting two versions of the same type of ideology. So there's a lot of frustration with people on the doors and a lot of apathy. And that's dangerous because that means, you know, there are people who are saying they might not go out and vote because they don't think that their vote matters. So it's convincing those people to go out. But the shift in the housing from 2014 to now is that in 2014, it was very much social housing. It was people who were on the housing list for about 12 years and couldn't get. Now what you're seeing is it's the people who are in rental accommodation who are just barely surviving or who are terrified their landlord is going to say, I'm selling the house, or my daughter's moving in because they're going to college, or that the rent cap is going to, of course, we know it's not working and they're having to pay. So now it's very much the rental sector that you're getting on the doors, that people are just so frustrated. They don't qualify for social housing. They don't qualify for affordable housing because they earn that little bit too much. And they're never going to be able to buy a house. So they are completely dependent on the private rental market.
And are hooked on things like HAP and hooked on things like rent allowance. And as you say, the other myth that needs to be burst here is that most of the recipients of HAP are working people. They just can't afford market rents. This is an outrage. Rents have gone up 7 times faster than wages in the last 4 years.
And it's the idea that, you know, years ago, people could survive on one income. Mm-hmm. We've now two incomes and you have families who are, you know, working families who are really, really struggling and terrified of the cost of living around childcare, around if their child gets sick, they get sick, something breaks. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that, like in this day and age, when yet all they're hearing on the radio and the TV is the economy's booming. We're, you know, we've the fastest growing economy in Europe. Aren't we great? And if you're sitting there going, well, I don't have a penny.
Then the economy is booming. The highest number of people in work in the history of the state, past 2.2 million and over 55.5 billion in a tax take. We've never touched that in the peak of the Celtic Tiger. Yet the majority of households are reliant on some form of social transfer to be lifted out of the at-risk of poverty. If we take that social transfer out, Ireland falls to Mexico levels of inequality. I'm sorry, guys, but that's the price that you're paying. Mm. So if you're feeling apathetic about it, you know, get angry instead.
And get out and just vote progressively.
I did hear an interesting story. You know, the way older people, little chat groups, my mom has a little chat group, and they were all talking about how they have their adult children still living with them at home and how they bloody well thought by the age of 30 that they'd at least, you know, be able to walk down to the fridge in their bra and knickers if they felt like it, you know. But now they can't.
And they can't. And I come across at least one case of that every single day. Like a woman who was telling me only recently, her daughter and her daughter's husband and their 2-year-old are back living, sharing one bedroom, and her 16-year-old and 18-year-old son and daughter now have to share a bedroom because they've to give up the other bedroom for the married daughter to come back and like that because they're not eligible for any of the social elements of it.
Shame if they were, there's none to get them.
Another woman whose daughter's a midwife. Do you know what I mean? Professional. Mm. But because she works shifts, she relies on her to look after her. So she's working nights. Her grandson stays with her. She said that, yes, she could probably afford a house if she moved to Mead or out into the other counties. But then she loses her childcare option.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
she's just
catch 22 the whole way.
Yeah. And it's a lot of that generation, like my parents' generation as well, who are just subsidizing or propping up, like, you know, the housing crisis would be even worse if we didn't have those parents who are putting up their adult children.
Thanks very much for coming in with us, Lynn. It's always a pleasure. A little bit of housekeeping. We need patrons. This pod survives on patrons. We're 1 month away from shutting down unless we get more patrons. Please sign up.
As we said at the outset, folks, this podcast was recorded shortly before the European elections, and we thought it was important to put it out now. Lynn has recorded a short clip on lessons that she has learned from the recent election, and actually there's no point me blabbering on anymore. You know, we'll put it over to Lynn. Here's 2 minutes of Lynn and why she thinks the left needs to work more closely together. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
The Twitter tributes were very, very nice and very touching, and, you know, a bit overwhelming at some point, because I think, if, you know, when you lose an election, you kind of feel that you've failed in some way, or you haven't actually delivered for people. And in fact, what they were saying was, you know, they were really thankful for the things that you have done. But I do think it's also born out of the fact that we've realised that we can do so much better, those of us on the left, in terms of working together. And you know, and it's not about selling out on your ideas, your ideology. We prove in the European Parliament that we can work together, even though we don't agree on everything in a left-wing group. So, yes, I'm a Republican, I'm a United Irelander, but I am a left-wing activist. And what I would love the lessons from this is that the left, if we can just get some sort of coordination, even just around voting strategically, that we can maximise the number of elected reps that the left returns, as opposed to actually handing seats over to Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil because we're fighting with each other. I think, you know, it's not about selling out on any political party's ideas, but it is about thinking strategically. And if we can work out a way to cooperate more effectively. And we did it with Right to Water, and we proved that's why we were able to successfully stop water charges, because the left came together and worked together. And we just need to go back and do that again and think, how can we maximise the left-wing vote? And by doing that, we can then show the tangible benefits to more people, that when you vote left, your life improves, as opposed to what's happening now, is where they're not seeing any tangible benefit to their life, because the same political parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, just keep getting back in.